Hey, Trojan fans, it's time to get into the huddle with the Peristyle Podcast. The Peristyle Podcast is your weekly ticket to USC football and recruiting news. Don't forget, you can download the podcast 24/7 at our website, peristylepodcast.com. And now, here's the host of the Peristyle Podcast, USCFootball.com publisher, Ryan Abraham.
Hello, Trojan fans. Welcome to the Peristyle Podcast on a Tuesday. We're going to talk some USC Trojan football with Dan Weber, beat writer and columnist for USCFootball.com, and Keely Yore, our newest reporter on USCFootball.com. She's in the studio with us. We're going to answer a lot of your USC football questions. It's kind of a crazy week. We got Pac-12 Media Day coming up Wednesday and Thursday. Then fall camp starting soon after that on the 29th. So it should be a lot of fun. Lots of stuff going on. Summer workouts have wrapped up, and we want to talk about all the topics heading into fall camp and, of course, the much-anticipated 2017 season. If you have any questions or comments, we do love to hear from you. Podcast at uscfootball.com. We'll try to get to each and every one of your emails. And if you want to call or text, you can do it at our number, 424-254-9141. That's 424-254-9141. It's our Google Voice number. You can text to it. You can leave a voicemail. Try to keep it brief. We don't want to be playing 2 or 3 minute voicemails on the podcast, but we would love to hear from you. If you want to subscribe, iTunes.com/Peristyle Podcast. And we're on Google Play and Stitcher Radio and Audio Boom, TuneIn Radio, all those different ways you can download our show. Leave us positive feedback. We love all that. And thanks for, making us part of your day here on the Peristyle Podcast. Well, let's welcome in first. I'll do Keely Yore. She's sitting right next to me. What's up, Keely? How you doing?
Hello. I'm good. A question. Do you plan out how long you say hello in the beginning? It always varies, the length.
Yeah. I probably have a face for radio and a voice for Morse code or something. So I'm not, that's an old reference. So it's not the best at that. So I just, whatever it lasts.
Like, you know, it's good.
As long as it'll hold out, then I'll.
It's your signature bit. It's good.
Yeah, it's a little bit there. And then we have Dan Weber too on the line, joining us via Skype. What's up, Dan?
Hey, not much. Busy week. We've been kind of aiming for this week, and we get the whole Megillah, finishing up all the previews and the preseason stuff and the Pac-12 media days and the team reports, and we get practice before the end of the week on Saturday. So this is a good one. This is why you get involved in this stuff. There's just that kind of natural buildup, and then all of a sudden it's here.
It is here, and it kind of happened with our transition on the website too. So if you guys haven't checked it out, uscfootball.com has a brand new platform. So I'm getting about an email every 10 or 15 minutes that they can't log in. So I'm helping everybody with that. Just basically go to our new website, go to uscfootball.com, log in with the same email address you had registered with Scout. If you forget the password, click forgot password, it'll send it to you. Get on there, jump on the Peristyle, and you can talk with all of us. Hopefully it'll work out. If you have any problems, you can always email me, podcast@uscfootball.com or ryan@uscfootball.com. But that's been a little crazy the last couple of days, but we still wanted to still putting up a lot of content. Dan has put up a lot of previews from fall camp. So there's a couple, 2 or 3 going up a day. Keely's been putting up videos. We've all been putting up stories. So lots of stuff going up on uscfootball.com. And Dan, one of the big questions we've been getting is, when's the practice schedule coming out? When's the practice schedule coming out? And if you guys remember, I put in the war room a few weeks ago, a little bird told me practices were going to be closed to the public, not to the media, but the public. And we didn't really talk about it on the show, but now we learned about that yesterday. So they sent out the practice schedule. There's one day off every week, which is a new NCAA rule. USC's taking Sundays off, starting on Saturday, like Dan said, but only July 29th, Saturday, and July 31st, Monday, will be open to the public because there's a new, or at least according to USC, there's a new NCAA rule making August a quiet or dead period in recruiting. They don't want recruits to be on campus, so they're closing practice to the public for that. So Eric in Duck Country had the first question. I wanted to get your thoughts on this, Dan. You too, Keely. Why are practices now closed? Is it just for fall camp, or will it continue into the season? Will the media still be allowed? Thanks, as always, Eric in Duck Country.
Yeah, I mean, when we say that they're closed, in most places, that means closed to the media. You know, that means like Like if you're in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, within a block of the stadium when they're practicing and you have a camera,
you may be
under arrest. So when we say closed at USC, it usually we're referring to the general public and fans. And it has been open in most of the preseason until they really get into game week preparation forever, certainly since we've been around. The new NCAA rule, the way USC is interpreting it with the month of August, is a dead period that you can't have, the potential of recruits and, other people being in the same location. You get different readings from different schools on this new rule and what it means. There are other places where it is impacting whether high school teams can play in college facilities in the month of August, and games, bowl games, kind of things like that have had to move out of college facilities because of the new rule. So it has some impact, but I think we tried to tell people who were planning to come to town in August to not be, maybe go to Disneyland or something, but you may not, you're not going to probably get to see practice, and that turns out to be the case. So you got 2 days, you got this Saturday and this Monday, and that's it. So I know they won't be in pads yet, but you will get to see two practices if you choose to do so. But it looks like our schedule hasn't really changed at all, that the media will go with the same schedule. So at least we're still in there. and that really matters, because we love, and I think that's one of the things USC football has done so well, and we thank all you guys out there, but being there, we like to be there, and we like to report, what we see there, and we like to get it to you, right away with instant analysis and ghost notes and all the other stuff and all the highlights and what have you. And so, it's hard to complain too much, because we're still in there, and we're getting a lot better view of USC football than almost anybody else around the country. So we'll have to be your eyes and ears in August.
Yeah, I was going to say, while it's easy to complain in the bubble of USC, we definitely are getting more access than a lot of programs around the country. So it's good, but it's bad.
Yeah, they've put extra restrictions, but overall, if you cover USC, you get more access than if you cover other major programs. So it's definitely a good thing, but it's been more and more restrictive pretty much every year, restricting in the summer. We're not going to get a lot of sympathy from. But it's basically for us, we want to provide you guys with the best coverage possible. So the more access we have, the easier that is, the more we can learn about the team and kind of share our thoughts on what we see and what's going on out there. But I think some of it is also the nature of being in Los Angeles. Like if you're in Tuscaloosa, if you're a newspaper within 100 miles, that's what your main thing is, Alabama football all the time. In Los Angeles, it's very different. I mean, you have multiple sports pro teams plus another major university. So if you close everything off and have zero access, there's just other schools, other programs that can be covered. So it's kind of strategic, I think, if you're a program here. If you want more coverage, you kind of have to give people access.
Well, also, how much does that play into?
Yeah, I was going to say, where I live, there's a lot of, in Orange County, a lot of attention that Chargers are here. They're in Costa Mesa. They're, going to be at such and such a sports center. I can't remember the name of the guy that the sports center is named after, where they built their new, practice facility. And they're all open. So, I think they may be opening the same day as USC. So you've got some competition. So I'm not sure you're in a position in LA to close everything down, with two NFL teams that are encouraging people to come to their preseason practices.
Yeah. And it also benefits them in a way, because that's something that when players are going on to the next level, USC always touts, well, oh, our players are media trained. They've had media in LA. They know what they're doing. So it also helps them in that way too, with the next level. So,
well, it's not, and it's not even a case of USC saying that. It really is true.
Yeah,
USC kids are so much more comfortable with a microphone in their face. And I mean, there are, honest to goodness, there are college coaches in the SEC that don't handle themselves as well as you know, USC's kids. I mean, you could be an assistant coach for Nick Saban, and they allow you to speak once a year. You know, you don't get a lot of media training. I'm surprised some of his guys, can get head coaching jobs because they just don't get to do that. And the USC kids really do. And I think it helps them in all the interviews they do with the NFL teams, before they get drafted. I think it plays in their favor. I think, like, Juju has just been a darling of the Pittsburgh media, and Stevie T has been a darling, down at Tampa Bay. I mean, the USC kids just have, and Adoree, of course, has kind of taken over Nashville. And it's really a plus for a kid coming out of the USC program. There's no question about that.
I think the assistant coach point is a very good one too, Dan, because like when, say, USC hires Dylan McCullough from Indiana, you can go on YouTube and see interviews he's done during the season, during practice, things like that, and you can kind of get a feel for what he's like. If you hire the running back coach from Alabama, you're not going to see anything from what he's doing there if he can talk to the media once a year. Now, it's a different way to skin a cat. You can say, hey, I got the I got the running back coach from Alabama. He's probably pretty darn good, you know. The one from Indiana, you could look at his track record, but you'd like to see what's going on. But that's what my point is, that, yeah, USC is a power program, one of the top five all time. But being in Los Angeles, it's a different market, and I think it's a mistake. You know, if you're working towards closing it and making it look like Alabama, I just think that would be a mistake in this market.
Yeah, you just can't do it. You can't do it. There's just so much TV time, and it's important. I think when you're walking up to the, Howard Jones Field, and you see those TV trucks there, that really matters, because there are a lot of places they could go. You got the Dodgers and the Angels and who knows what. And before, you're much into October, you got both hockey teams and both, NBA teams. And, you really want them stopping by once or twice a week at practice. And, you close that practice, they're not going to be there. And, I don't know how you can calculate that, but, I think the Dodgers have, with their TV contract, were, as good as they are and as much as people want to watch them, they can't watch them. And, you understand now that Major League Baseball, is even worried about, here we got one of our two or three great franchises, and most people, even in L.A., they can't see them. And that's a worry. They're getting a lot of money, but it's hard for people to, to watch the Dodgers. And I think people understand that probably not a good long-term plan for the Dodgers.
Let's move on. We got Mark had a question. He said, a couple of years ago, I offered an opinion that the offensive line was not as good as their respective five-star designations would warrant. Each of you indicated that the problem was not the player's ability, but rested in the coaching ability. Lately, it appears that your opinions have changed and you regard the current group of players at a higher ability than the previous group. Are the current players better, or are you just rethinking your opinion on the previous group? Love to hear your discussion during the next broadcast. From Mark.
Well, I mean, I think we all feel real, confident in Neil Callaway. I think he is, everything he's ever done, his background and all of that. And I think there's a stability with him that there wasn't in previous years, no matter who was there. And he had some good ones and some not, so good ones, but there was this constant shuffling and moving through the ranks. There were some limitations. I mean, they had some big guys who could do some things and couldn't do other things. And, guys with, the five star, were really good in high school. And that's probably the hardest thing, I think, to evaluate kids coming out of high school at the line of scrimmage, because the guys they're playing against are never, almost ever, ever close to what they're going to be playing against in college every play, every day. And it's just really hard to say, is this just because this guy was so big and nobody could challenge him, or is he athletic enough to be able to make those plays, at the college level? And so that was kind of an issue, for Zach and Damian and those guys. But, they were veterans. They tried hard. you know, they tried to take advantage of the things, you know, that they could do well. But, you know, it was a combination of things, I think, you know, with them. I mean, in last year, you get the really good break. Say the last 10 games, Sam Darnold is sacked only 10 times, or 6 times, I'm sorry, 6 times in 10 games. That's pretty unbelievable. And then you realize that probably wasn't completely dependent on the line of scrimmage play. That was very much dependent on Sam Darnold. And the fact that, you know, no matter how many times somebody got through, the first guy almost never took Sam down. So, you know, you can read the stats one way or the other. But I don't think they paid a big penalty last year for maybe being slightly immobile and unable to maybe do. They paid a penalty against Alabama. I mean, you know, there were guys head on, you know, on USC's players. And Alabama, they wouldn't even touch it. I mean, Alabama kids, you know, be in the backfield having been untouched. And so that wasn't necessarily their strong point, but I don't know if that was a failure in coaching or whatever it was. They just weren't athletic enough probably to be able to do, you know, to do some of the things you'd like them to do. Had they gotten Alabama in the last game of the season, I think they figured out, well, this is what we can do, and this is what we can't do. But I don't know if that's a good enough answer or not, but I think you do change your opinion as you go along and you see, you know, more of the coaching, you see more of the, you know, the players develop. And so I don't know that it was like we ranked those guys better then or we ranked them worse now or we ranked these guys better. It's just, you know, I think it really changes each year with, you know, both the coach and the scheme and the talent, you know, behind them as well. I mean, you can make a great block if that guy doesn't hit the hole, doesn't get the timing right, all that, you know, it doesn't make any difference. So, you know, it's hard to separate one, you know, element from another.
Yeah, I'm always so curious about when in regards to the O-line, how much the coaching plays. I mean, this upcoming year is the first time that they've had a coach for 2 years in a row. You know, guys like Chad Wheeler, Zach Banner had 5 different O-line coaches. You know, how much does that play into all that as well? So that's what I always think about too.
Yeah, there's no question. That's absolutely true. I mean, I think there were years these guys were kind of coaching themselves.
Yeah.
And that's probably not a good thing. It's certainly not probably a good thing for Zach to say, okay, Zach, you just kind of coach yourself, you know. Well, he didn't mind doing that probably, and I don't know that that was the best thing for him.
He does, so, like,
yeah,
to hear,
I think,
himself,
the guy, you know, probably yelled at himself a lot. 2 years in a row are really going to benefit from that.
So I think Keeley stole my note. I wrote down like 5 O-line coaches in 5 seasons, and that's what Keeley said. So I don't know.
Sorry about that.
I don't know about having her in my studio here.
You can kick me out.
I'm always afraid when they mention that because there might be a quiz and they ask you to name all 5 of them. And it's like, let's see.
Well, there was one. Remember,
Tim Drevno is the farthest I go back right now off the top of my head.
Well, and Tim Drevno, and then you say, well, wow, he's the offensive coordinator, you know, at Michigan, I guess. He's still there, right?
Yeah.
For Harbaugh. So, so he moved upward and onward, and one of the $1 million assists. I think they have 4 assistants at Michigan. Maybe it's 5 now, making $1 million or more a year. So, so Drevno has done very nicely by being with Harbaugh.
It kind of goes back to the Lane Kiffin years. And there was a couple of years where USC had 2 offensive line coaches. So basically USC had James Craig and everyone felt he should be fired. I think people told Lane Kiffin he has to fire him. And to be defiant, he didn't fire him. He kept him on, but moved him and then hired another offensive line coach. So it was kind of like, that was one of those immature moments by Lincoln, but that kind of started this downward spiral.
Everybody needs a driver though, don't they?
Yeah. I think that's what it was.
Sometimes you just move him aside and you know, and the guy he brought in, and that's one of the things that Lane did so well. He brings in a, you know, Mike Summers, I guess, right? From Florida, and he's back at Louisville, I guess now, but, very good coach, kind of a Neil Callaway, you know, sort of a guy. But things just didn't go together. They just, you know, just bringing this guy and this guy doesn't necessarily make it work.
Well, let's go to the Bay Area. Keith in Oakland, he goes, I enjoy the podcast. My questions are for Dan. Number one, has there been any progress made this summer in regards to the kicking game?
We don't know a lot about that. That's a really good question. I think I've seen Chris Tilby one time. They don't normally work out when we're around. Yeah, in terms of what's happened since the spring, I don't think we know. And I think he may have even gone home. When we say home, we're not talking about, you know, San Diego. We're talking about Melbourne. I think it's Melbourne, Australia. So, but he's the holdover. You got a new snapper. You're going to have a new place kicker. You're going to have a new, all the return guys are probably going to be new. So there'll be a whole new special team kind of a deal, but we really don't get a sense of that in the summer because smartly, they don't need to be necessarily with everybody else when they're working out. I mean, I think Tilby can be one of those big leg kickers if they let him, if they, you know, say, go ahead and just turn it loose every single time. I think he can. As to the place kicker, you know, Mike Brown kicked a 57 yarder in high school and he earned a scholarship last year. He redshirted. And then there's a kid from modern day, preferred walk on and Chase McGrath, I guess, who people really like. So there'll be a little competition, you know, for the kickers, but it'll be interesting to see. As much emphasis as there is on special teams with Baxter once they get into practice mode, a lot of that is on, you know, on the coverage and blocking and blocking kicks and all that. It's still not as much on the guys actually doing the kicking. But I think we'll have a sense. They put them under decent pressure, and I think we'll have a sense with that, you know, place kicker, which one of the two, and whether you're going to have. They do a lot of work on kickoff, and I think last year you got the sense that, you know, they were going to be able to kick the ball into the end zone most of the time, and I think they got much more comfortable doing that than trying to directionally kick it a little bit short and cover. I think they feel like, so I don't know what they're thinking this year. Maybe we won't know until they really get a sense of in fall practice whether they're going to trust the kickoff guy to just go and, you know, bust it into the end zone like Bormister did last year.
And his second question was, what three things are you most interested in observing at the first week of fall camp? So we'll get you and Keeley to answer this one.
I think I want to see how they want to run the ball. You get a sense of you know, what's the basic philosophy of the run game going to be? How's it going to fit in? I think we kind of have a sense of how they're going to distribute the ball, you know, in the passing game and what they're going to expect of Sam and all the things, you know, and that they're going to be a whole lot of wide receivers and tight ends that they're going to get a chance to catch it. But I think the running game and how they, what's the basic, part of the run game. Secondly, I'd like to see how they're going to get pressure on the quarterback. I think they had 26 sacks last year, and I guess it's not terrible, but it's not very good with the athletes they had and with a philosophy to play on the other side of the line of scrimmage. So I think that would be the second thing. Because I think that changes the whole nature of the secondary and their ability to make plays if you can really get pressure on the quarterback. And I guess the third thing will be special teams, just to get a sense of, you know, when you're starting over with almost every part of your special team, what does that look like? I think that matters. And we, as a matter of fact, don't know a lot about how that's going to go, but that'd be kind of the things I might look at.
I'm really curious about the wide receiver group, just how that all shakes out. Because, like, besides Deontay Burnett, maybe Jalen Green just because of seniority, it's kind of a open season for who wants to grab what spot. So I'm interested to see how that develops, because it's really up for grabs. Like, whether or not Michael Pittman, he definitely in spring was showing signs of being one of the guys, but this is the first time that there's not some superstar waiting in the wings. You know what I mean? Like Juju after Nelson left, or, you know, there's kind of
open, like Robert season. Woods and Marquise Lee and Nelson Aguilar and Juju Smith-Schuster. There was a 5-star guy who played as a freshman.
Yeah.
And you haven't, they don't have one like that this year.
So I'm really curious to see who kind of shows up.
Oh, to be honest, watching him in the summer, Deontay Burnett is that kind of, you know, that Jerry Rice guy. He's not the fastest. He's not the biggest. He's not just the best. You know, he catches it. He gets open. Got great body control. So I think you do have that sort of a guy, although how they'll use him, I don't think we know. But I think you're really right on the rest of them. Man, you can just, you know, you go to practice and you watch like a Jody Lewis or a Randall Grimes, and you think, okay, put them in there too. I mean, or you see a Josh Amater baby, and you think, man, that kid, you know, that's Juju, only jumps higher. And so I don't have a clue. And I think you're right, Kelly. There's just shake them up and see who comes out.
Yeah, and it's not only just quantity, it's quality. Like you said, they're good. So it'll be interesting to see who fends for themselves.
I would put the offensive line there too, just to see what, you know, cause we saw like an Andrew Voorhees come in the spring and no one really expected him to be like, hey dude, he could play, like he could start. You know, Austin Jackson, could he come in there and do that? Yeah. We talked to, it was funny yesterday. We talked to Harvey Hyde and, he wants things mixed up. He likes Chris Brown better at tackle than at guard. He wants Lobendon at guard and not tackle. And I was telling him, well, that's kind of not the way they've been doing things. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, Dan, but I think there's a lot of options, a lot of ways they could go with it.
Yeah, how they end up mixing and matching the offensive line, because, you know, I think they're giving, I think I really like this staff that, and Clay, you play, you know, the way you practice, you're going to get a chance to play. And there is that legitimate ability to make yourself, make a spot for yourself. Based on practice, and I don't think it's well, where do we recruit you, and how, you know, how important are you to our recruiting efforts, and we'll get you in there because we got to show everybody that our recruits, you know, from wherever you're from, play and all that. You don't get any sense of that. They're just going to try to figure out who, you know, is Nico the center, and Toa the, you know, the left tackle, and you know, how quickly does an Andrew Voorhees at right tackle come along, or is Austin Jackson, who certainly looks the part and looks like he could run, obviously, as a former, you know, member of their relay team at 6'6 and 300-plus pounds in high school. But how soon does it take to, you know, and how do they make sure that they give him a chance to show whether they can do that? I mean, things have changed. It used to be a true freshman playing an offensive line at this level. It's just not happening. And yet the last 2 years, Alabama has started a true freshman tackle. And the one kid was from Folsom, California. So it's not unheard of anymore, even at, you know, the Alabama level. So, how that all goes together on the offensive line. And I don't know that, because of the being not in pads, I don't know you'll see that the first week, but, you know, the first few weeks, I think that'll be a real focus once they get into pads.
Let's Tarek had a question. What steps does Biggie Marshall need to take to grow from a good cornerback to an elite cornerback?
I think he's just got to trust his ability. And he does it. He's so competitive. And I was talking to him about this the other day. He so wants to shut you down. He so wants to stop you that he has gotten a little handsy, early in the play when he didn't need to be. And, I just think trust his ability, and I think he's grown up to the point where he can trust his ability and run with the guy and make the play when the ball gets there, and you know, redirect him and do all the things that he should be doing. You know, at 6'1", 200 pounds, you know, big and strong, a corner as he is, he can do all that. But just that, I mean, I just think he's got such a will to, I can't let anybody do anything against me. And he's had a little trouble at times resisting that urge to just grab somebody if they do something that surprises him. And I think at that point, he got to trust his ability to stay in the play and stay with the ball and be a better athlete, you know, when the ball gets there. And I think that's a lot of judgment. Some of it's coaching. I mean, I think we got to see some things happen there at the coaching level. I mean, I think there was a good discussion on the board the other day about Adoree, who didn't ever seem to benefit from all of the kinds of ways to play the football and use his hands that maybe, you know, athletically he could have done. And some of that was he wasn't there in spring and all that. But I think they probably, you know, as a group, need to really learn how to play the ball, how to not, you know, grab anybody, and how to trust their ability. They're all good enough athletes. But, you know, have the confidence in yourself that you can make the play and you don't have to grab that guy. You know, I mean, we'll still think about that, the Utah game where last year where, you know, Biggie doesn't grab that kid. They don't get a first down and the game's over. And can't do that anymore. He's just got to not have that. And he knows it. He knows. But that's what I'd like to see from, you know, from Biggie.
We got one from Josh, Dan. He goes, "Hey, Dan, Ryan," and then he puts "and Keeley?" question mark.
Oh, wow.
So he's already anticipating that you were going to be joining the show.
Nice job.
Yeah. There you go, Josh. I love the show. Well, thank you, Josh. I love that I can listen to the podcast for my Trojan football fix during the off season. Hype makes me nervous. The last time the Trojans entered a season with this much preseason hype was the 2012 season, and that didn't end too well for our boys. The final record of 7-6, 5-4 in the Pac-12 South. I know that season was in the middle of the sanctions era, but is there a chance history can repeat itself? What is Clay and the rest of the staff doing to keep the team focused on performance and not all of the hype? Thanks a lot. Josh from the Mojave Desert.
Yeah, Josh, I think that season went bad. The day Matt Barkley said he was coming back, they had the Christmas tree up in Heritage Hall. And I still remember, you know, it was like, this is all USC needs. He's coming back. Unfinished business. It's all going to be taken care of. And I think, unfortunately, those guys were not so far removed from the Pete Carroll era where they didn't think maybe there's just some magic about USC and it's all going to happen. And I still remember trying to, and, you know, they were coming off of that team. I think the 2011 team might have been ranked, you know, barely in the top 10, but by the end of the year, they might have been able to beat anybody in the country. I mean, you know, I know it was tough. You know, they crushed Oregon for three quarters, and then Monty went into prevent, and they ended up needing a missed field goal to, you know, to win that game. But that was a really good Oregon team that, you know, that they were just significantly better than, you know, on the road. So I think people kind of thought, well, that's going to carry over. Unfortunately, the guy who, you know, the two guys who really drove that team were, Matt Khalil and Rhett Ellison. They were the enforcers. They were the tough guys. They were the, you know, the real talents on that team. And when they left, a lot of the toughness went with them. And, you know, I still remember writing that I think they're good enough, but, and I said, there's, you know, one big question mark, and the question mark is the coach. And goodness gracious, you couldn't even have guessed where that season was going in terms of the coaching and all of the issues. And there are people who are probably better off not coming off that kind of a big year. And, you know, the whole, you know, the year starts with, well, did you vote for USC number one or didn't you vote for USC number one or you did, but you lied about it, da, 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 da. I mean, it was just one of those after another, you know, culminating in the Sun Bowl. I don't think any of that's possible with this team. I think this team, Clay has, you know, it's not about Clay. It's about them. It's about practice. It's about routine. It's about technique. It's about none of the other stuff that's out there. It's not about, you know, who's coming back or who's not or any of that. It's just, you know, I mean, I think he was smart enough to, right after the Rose Bowl, talked about it's not about the Rose Bowl. As much as everybody was excited and thrilled to death about how the Rose Bowl went, I think they were very wise in saying, you know, that game's not going to help us now. You know, it might help you recruiting, might help you other ways, but it's not going to help you on the field. And I think this group of guys are far enough removed from the Pete Carroll, you know, dominant era that they don't know any other way. I mean, I don't think this group feels like it's owed to them. They have more of an attitude of, if we outwork everybody and we out-tough everybody and, you know, we have all of this as background, we will win those games. And that was how the kind of the Pete Carroll era got started, is they believed that, we've practiced tougher than everybody else. We've practiced harder. We work at it more than they do. When push comes to shove, we're going to win. This team is closer to that, that it's more about how you got here than the fact that you're USC and that kind of the world owes you something because you're USC. I don't get any sense of that with this team much at all. And that's so I think that's a big difference.
Yeah, like you said, the first practice of spring, Clay Helton was like, the Rose Bowl is done. It's over. I've only watched it once, and that's it. I'm not going to watch it again. It's over. And it kind of has that ripple effect through the team. I mean, just talking to the guys, though, they definitely think a national championship is in their sights. They are very confident. But the thing is like, other seasons ago, players would say that, but they kind of would say it because it's the right thing to do. You know, yeah. Like, oh, like, well, of course the national championship's our goal. Why not? Why wouldn't that be our goal? You know, but these guys actually are like, no, like, we work hard. Like, we think that we can really do it, as opposed to like, we think that this is what we should say and we yeah. should do. You know, there's a difference. And I think the turnaround from a horrible beginning of the season last season to they put in the work, they bought in and look where they ended. They're like, okay, if we keep doing that and that work, what will happen next, you know? So
it's funny. I think
it's very much connected to what they do, not who they are. It's like mm-hmm. we are what we do, because they found out. They showed up at, you know, play Alabama thinking, we're USC. Look at us. We're big shots. And that they found out how far that went. And then they realized, okay, you are what you do. And you either get ready and you're able to do it or get off the field because you're not going to be good enough. You're right. That was an unbelievably good learning lesson the month of September last year.
And Dan, if I'm not mistaken, so there were so many distractions. I think our buddies over at Rain of Troy did like a whole episode on the disaster that was the 2012 season, like everything that went wrong. And it was pretty funny if you want to go back and do that. But there were so many things like painting slogans on the turf. Like there were so many things that were just distractions, you know, leading up to the players not even wanting to go to El Paso and all that stuff. But the one I remember most is Lane Kiffin got so adamant about talking about injuries. Like he was so worried. Like he became so worried. And I think it was Khalid Holmes.
That's the one, by the way, that's the one I remember the most too.
Well, yeah, because you were intimately involved. Khalid Holmes was like injured and, you know, he missed the game. So that was the Cyrus Hobby game where he got overwhelmed against Stanford. So they didn't play Abe Markowitz, or they could have, and like, cause Kiffin didn't like him or whatever. So they could have pretty won that game if Kiffin's ego would have checked. They just played.
Or they could have put John Martinez at center.
Yeah.
They didn't
something
want to
like
do that.
But anyway, you basically just asked him something about, hey, there was like practice was upbeat today. Is it because, you know, Holmes is back because he came back from his injury? And Kiffin, like, I mean, it was like a 12-year-old child, and he like just, he said, I'm out of here or whatever, and just walked away. Like, just it was the most embarrassing.
That was, Dan started that?
Dan started that.
Oh, Dan, how come you never told me that?
And I tried, this, I felt sorry for him. So I gave him a softball question. I gave him a chance to say, yeah, it's great. We got our center back. Things are going to be good. You know, we got that, put that Stanford game out of our mind, because basically that's one of the few games in history where they lost the game because of one guy in one position who didn't want to be there. He flat out did not want to play that position. They had two guys that did, and they didn't play them. So you could have questioned them about that, but no, I said, I'll be nice to Lane. I'll ask him about, you know, Holmes coming back. And he didn't, that's where he had a missing chip of some sort, because he didn't get that, that I was actually trying to help him out and get a good quote as well. But when he walked off, it was one of the more stunning moments that, you know, I've ever been around covering, you know, college football. It was like, this is so dumb. We're trying to help. We threw you a life preserver, buddy.
What'd you do afterwards, he, Dan?
Huh?
What'd you do afterwards?
The nice thing is when you know what you're doing and you don't feel like, you know, I did anything at all, because everybody else is like, gosh, we're not. Although I think people are smart enough now to say, I don't care if he didn't do the rest of the press conference. This is gold. Yeah. We got him on video walking away. It's going to be everywhere tonight. So I don't, nobody was mad, because this didn't hurt their covering that practice, because they loved it.
We normally don't film the head coach scrum because USC films it and they put it up. Well, obviously they didn't put it up that day. So our friend Lindsay Theory, I think, had the best, view. And it was like 18 seconds. Like, he literally just, like, I forget what the words were. It's like, I gotta go. Yeah.
I'm out of here.
It was like, what just happened? Like, or, you know, it's like you took a kid's, you know, toy away and he just walked off. And it was to me, like, I would look at that and that's like an unhirable thing. Like, I would never hire that guy. Like, yeah, you'd have to prove to me.
Exactly right.
You
weren't supposed to talk about injuries, but injured guys coming back, that wasn't off limits. It was an injured guy who was going to play. And it was obvious he was going to play. It wasn't like, oh, you don't have a center this week. No, it was, you got a center this week. Isn't that a good thing?
When
you throw them a life preserver and they just, you know, they swim on by and say, I don't want that life preserver.
That's cool. Well, there's a little Dan Weber history there, because we got a question later on that wants a little bit more of that. So that's some good insight into Dan on the USC beat. We got Paul next up. He says, Ryan, I got a question specifically for you. Okay, so you two can take a seat for a second. How would you feel about opening with Alabama this year? After last year's ass whip, are you glad we won't see them again until the national championship game? Or do you think we've progressed enough now? Do you feel it would be okay for us to take them on now and win or lose? You could have a great season and catch them in a championship game. This has to be Florida State's mindset, don't you think? Paul in Vegas. And Paul, I'll answer and let the rest of the crew do too. I'd certainly think USC has a better shot this year than last year. If you look at the previous question about the hype and all that, because Clay Helton hasn't done all this before, I think it's all uncharted territory. Like Dan was saying, it looks like they're doing the right things. They're not doing the kind of dumb small things that just pile up. And at the end, when it's a disaster, you go, wow, we can kind of see this coming. If it's a disaster this year, I don't think you're seeing it coming. It would just more be about that you hired a guy that doesn't have a lot of experience and maybe he didn't handle it behind the scenes well. I don't think that's the case, though. So I think if you had to pick a year, last year was a terrible year for it. This year would be much better. Are they to the Alabama level yet? I would still probably pick an Alabama in that game. But they seem to be on the right track. And a team like Florida State, they won a national championship in the last few years. The Pac-12 hasn't won one in 12. So, I mean, this is, you know, having a championship under your belt and the head coach, Jimbo Fisher, doing that, you give them a puncher's chance in that game, even though Alabama's been the bell cow of college football. You know, they're one of the favorites to win the national championship. USC's, you know, a 7-5 favorite right now to make the college football playoff. So I think this year you could take even a close loss or even, a two touchdown loss or something Alabama early, you could still go back, be a better team by the end of the year and make the national championship. So I think it'd be better this year, but it's not like I'd be saying, oh yeah, USC would kill Alabama if they started this year.
Yeah. No, I would think that, Alabama, there are some issues, and USC was unable to exploit any of them, but I mean, Alabama didn't even have a starting quarterback yet last year. I mean, they started the other kid and then found Hurts. And USC had a chance. They just weren't even remotely ready to take advantage of it. But by the end of the year, I think USC offensively was very comparable to Clemson. And, what Clemson put up, 42 points on them? And Alabama, if you're really competent offensively, it's tough, I think, a little bit to come out of the Southeastern Conference because you just don't see teams that are really competent offensively. I mean, Alabama, they may have a big game with LSU every year, but LSU can't play offense or hasn't been. And I know they're saying, oh, we got quarterbacks in the league this year, which is interesting, that they'd have to talk about that. But I think Sam going, I mean, they put up 52 and took off some time against a really solid Penn State defense. So by the end of the year, I think they've got a chance. I think the big difference would be, USC would, I'd be really disappointed if this defense with a whole year for these guys, to get bigger and stronger and smarter and all the other parts of it. I'd be really surprised if they, made it easy for Alabama. I mean, last year's defense, they, God only knows, all the mistakes they made in that game. I wouldn't see that happening again, but, I think it's fine if they don't have to get them early in the year. I mean, getting, Stanford and Texas in the first three games is plenty. And, I think that's just about right. And where you want to be, and kind of build. And if you have to beat, Washington in the championship game, again, that's another, a team that people think also has a chance to get to the playoffs. So, that'd be perfect. And, my perfect scenario is, you beat Washington, let's say, in the championship game, and you finish second or third in the nation, and that gets you a chance to play at the Rose Bowl. And the ideal thing would be if you could get, say, Ohio State also finish second or third, and you get an Ohio State USC Classic Rose Bowl as the first semifinal game, and then the second game is in the Sugar Bowl, and say you have Alabama against, Florida State again or something like that. And then the two winners go and play in that brand new Mercedes-Benz Stadium in Atlanta. I think to me, that's the dream scenario because you'd have the build-up, you'd have the UCLA game, then you get a bye, and a build-up. If you win the South, you build up to play at Levi's Stadium against Washington. Then you'd have, three or four weeks build-up to the Rose Bowl, and then another, 10 days to go to Atlanta. I mean, if USC could pull that off, that would be one of those, just couldn't ask for anything more. If you could combine the Rose Bowl and the playoffs, it'd be just about as good as, it'd be better than anything that Pete got to do because of the extra game. But that would be, if I'm a USC fan, that's the dream scenario.
This is kind of modifying the question, but I would want USC to play Alabama again just this year so you could compare what the difference is, how much how well did they buy into Clancy's system, because it took time for it to really take into effect over last season. So, and then seeing Sam Darnold instead of Max Brown, I think that would be interesting just to compare and see the difference.
Yeah.
Well, they can do that at the end of the year.
Yeah.
That's true.
Cool. We got Nick. He said, hello, Trojan fans, on his intro. My question is for Dan about looking back on the tenure of Pat Hayden. I know a lot of people have bashed Pat, but let's look at his hirings in athletics from Steve, Andy, Ed O, Clay. academic graduation rates and GPA raising, etc. He can't be that bad as the media has portrayed him. Fight on from Nick. I disagree, Nick, but go ahead. Yeah.
Nick, did I hear you gave Pat credit for Ed O? See, that was part of the problem. I mean, I don't think, to be honest, Clay Helton was not a Pat Hayden hire. I mean, that was a Max Nikias informed by some people who he listened to. I think once you've hired Steve Sarkisian and then failed to fire him after failing to fire Lane Kiffin after the Sun Bowl and all that went on with that, I don't think Pat was probably somebody that they were listening to. I will give him credit, and I didn't think the Andy, I think the Andy Enfield thing, I was probably one who said bring back Tim Floyd. I think he got a bad deal. Other than that, the next guy on my list was Andy. I liked Andy personally. I liked his intelligence, his smarts, his background, all that. I think it took a little longer to get there. I think the big part that you got to give Pat credit or someone is that they allowed Andy to hire his two assistants, coaches Bland and Hart, that they are just sensational recruiters. It makes it for a great staff at USC. I do think, you know, with the depth they've got this year, they've got to figure out how are we going to use all of those good players, and that's before even the potential that Marvin Bagley, number one player in the nation, leaves high school early and goes to college, which looks like he is. And here you've got USC in the maybe final two with Duke. Are you kidding? And yet USC always should have been that program. I mean, you know, in a brand new building at a campus that's just this wonderful place, a mile and a half from LA Live, a mile and a half from two NBA franchises. There's no other school in America where a kid can come play, and there are two NBA, teams right down the street. I mean, and people forget that when O.J. Mayo was there and Kevin Love at UCLA, and that those teams would play one another, and you'd have literally 25 NBA scouts at every game. I mean, you can get, as much exposure as you ever could possibly want if you play at USC. They just had a run of some of the worst, coaching, ideas that anybody ever had in the world. But past legacy, I think once you hired Sark with all that everybody knew going into that hire, and you had Ed who, easily you could have, left in place. And that was such a disaster that there's no way you come back from that. I mean, that's one of those disqualifiers it was a good, a good tenure. No, not really. I mean, it started off badly. I mean, it was somebody who didn't understand what happened with the whole NCAA situation. It was started with, it ended up with somebody who a couple of times during his tenure, the NCAA, according to everybody that knows what was going on, was ready to come out with some give backs and, scholarships or wins or whatever, because they were, caught dead to rights with the information that came out in the Judge Schaller decision. And then they decided, no, we're not going to do it because it'll hurt us in the McNair, lawsuit. But that's where I think if you're the AD at USC, you call a press conference and say, these guys lied to me. These guys, we had an agreement in place, and then they backed out of it, but that never happened, and that should have happened. USC needed somebody standing up for USC, and that didn't happen. And that whole, we're going to win the right way. I mean, I tried to tell Pat once, I said, I think of the top 25 programs in America, that maybe Stanford is cleaner, cleaner than USC, but there are a lot of programs in that top 25 that aren't anywhere near as clean and fair and honest as USC was during that whole period. and I said, I know those people were convinced that USC was cheating because they knew how much cheating they would have had to do. For them to be as good as USC, they'd have had to cheat like unbelievably, you know, and they just were sure USC was cheating. So that's why when they, you know, they wrote them up on the Reggie Bush stuff, and they were convinced, I mean, they, I would have spoken out about this. For example, the NCAA decided first, USC's guilty. They decided second, we're going to give them penalties worse than we gave Miami, because as a favor to Paul D., the chairman of the former Miami AD, chairman of the committee, and then we'll go out and find the evidence. Well, that's why it took them 4 years before they even brought USC, you know, in for the hearing, because they couldn't find anything. And then finally, they ended up essentially framing Todd McNair and making stuff up. And I just think at no time would I have agreed to accept that if I'm USC. And they got the benefit when Judge Schaller decided, and they Todd McNair's attorneys were so smart, and they got the NCAA to make a fatal mistake. They tried to get the case thrown out, and the McNair attorneys got discovery. And that's when they found the emails. And they found that the NCAA was making stuff up, knew they were wrong, breaking their own rules, and they got a judgment. Never before in history has a school gotten been presented with that kind of a judgment about what the NCAA did. It won't happen again either, because nobody's going to email anybody ever at the NCAA. But I just don't think at that point you sit back and say, well, we know what they did, but we're just not going to say anything. No. I mean, so for me, that really makes it hard for Pat's tenure to be considered, you know, a successful one.
Yeah, I would say, I don't want to dwell on this too much. We had other questions, but basically, if you look at all the major decisions Pat Hayden made, unfortunately, if you did the exact opposite on all of them, USC would be in a much better position than they are now. So that's, I'll stand by that 100%, and I know that is true. So we'll move on.
You know, if you'd have blindfolded them and just threw darts and accepted whatever it hit, you'd have been better off. I mean, you're right. Either way.
Yeah. I like Pat Hayden. I mean, I like him a lot. It was cool. Like, he was a cool guy to be around, but just all of the decisions, he needed to be the smartest guy in the room, and he's a very smart guy, but he just made a lot of bad decisions, and that's what you're paid to do. He was the highest paid athletic director in the world, and yeah, that was bad. Okay, yeah. Anthony in L.A., he said, hello, Peristyle. First off, great work as always, guys. Dan and Ryan, and I guess I'll throw Keely in there. With fall camp and full pads coming, I'm really excited about our running back group. Rojo, Aka Cedric Ware, Vi, Stephen Carr. It's really going to be interesting who emerges as the number two. What position groups are you two excited about coming into camp because of our strength of depth in those areas? Thanks as always, Anthony in L.A.
Well, I think we've already mentioned wide receivers. I think you got to like tight ends, although, I mean, I think there are three at the very top level, a really serviceable walk-on kid, Austin Appleby, and the two freshmen who I don't think have to play, but, you know, may, you know, try to, you know, push the situation. But I think with Kerry Angeline's development at tight end, and, you know, he says he's probably 6'8" now, 245, runs the field, great hands. With Daniel Amaterbaby, who's 6'4", 244, I think the last he said. And, you know, and Tyler Petit, who's been a, you know, a guy that's been in there for, this will be his third year. I think they're going to be able to do a lot of things with those guys. And I think it's going to be hard to pay attention to them with the way they're going to attack with the wide receivers. But I don't discount that the running backs are going to be fun to watch. And I don't know if it's going to be a real, you know, system where you've got a very defined, you know, 1-2-3. I think they're going to do things with two running backs in the game. I really do believe that. I think they're going to throw the ball to the running backs in a lot of different places and kind of extended handoffs. I remember as a SID at Xavier, we were in a years ago. We were in a college basketball tournament at Brigham Young, and they were going to a bowl game. It was, you know, December. And I went out and watched them practice every day. I'd been a high school football coach. And it all of a sudden hit me. And they were the only ones in the country doing it then with Lavelle Edwards. And I'm thinking, I see what they're doing. Those are just long handoffs. Those are just extended, you know, that's a running play. But they didn't have great tailbacks. They didn't have great, you know, athletic offensive linemen. But they could pass block. And they would come out and throw the ball with those quarterbacks one after another. And I said, this is their run game. It's just, they're just long handoffs. And I think USC's going to do a lot of stuff that make you think, you know, those are long handoffs. They threw the ball the other day, to Ronald Jones on the sideline, and he put it in gear. And you're thinking, huh, you know, he's 205 pounds now. I think he's actually more explosive at 205 and pretty much the same weight Reggie was when Reggie, you know, junior year. And there are times when he does, and again, it's unfair to ever compare anybody there, but there, you know, with Reggie, but there are times where he does things and you think, wow, okay, that's special. And, now how it goes after that, Aka Cedric Ware is tougher than, you know, you could possibly, you know, hope for a guy. Stephen Carr, you know, 210 pounds, he just catches the ball, and I know T. Martin was raving about him, you know, his ability to catch it. And we've seen Vavai do everything that's asked of him in the spring, and he's just one of those, you know, all-purpose guys that catch it and run it. it's going to be fun to see, you know, how that breaks out or how they, I mean, I'm kind of hoping that they run tempo and that they play like they're two touchdowns behind, and they play fast and not, you know, kind of the way they did it with Sark, where we're trying to, can we keep track and get 100 plays? But you would like to see them average 90 plays and really, really give, all those guys a chance to get a number, you know, carries and catches and all of that, because I think they all deserve it. So, but that's kind of what I'll be looking at.
I think the whole offense is kind of a cop-out, but the whole offense is interesting to me, just because you might have in each position group, like, the number one guy, but after that, you don't really know yet, which is, I think, is interesting, because usually the offense seems to be more set in stone than the defense, but it's kind of opposite this season.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I kind of want to see the front seven, because it's, sometimes you see two down defensive linemen. Maybe this year you could see four at times. You know, we're not sure, you know, where the bodies, you know, there's a lot of good bodies there. And it's really up to Clancy who he feels comfortable with, who he has confidence in, and how that's basically how he's going to tailor the defense. So, there might be a few more bodies, Dan, on the defensive line this year that you can play with.
And there are. And if they only play two, and again, you know, only Stanford and maybe Utah, I don't, you know, are the kind of team where you really do have to stop the run first. I don't know how many they're going to play. But if they only play two, they're sure going to be able to rotate. I mean, they're going to have guys that, you know, that they can come in and play fast with. And I think the thing you hope is that they really trust those guys, and where they don't need, 25-year-old guy like Stevie with his strength and all that to just say, okay, hold him off, Stevie, from, you know, A-gap to A-gap. And with the feeling that we can send guys and use their speed and athleticism, you know, to get places and you know, Clancy always talks about wanting to play on the other side of the line of scrimmage. I think that's the key is, can you, you know, get enough, you know, guys who are ready to play fast and play on the other side of the line of scrimmage and just turn them loose. And, you know, take advantage of Rasheem Green's, you know, 275-pound, you know, really athletic body, or Kenny Bigelow, does he come back and have that ability? He's kind of trimmed down to 285. And they've got guys that, you know, I mean, they certainly look the part. I mean, then you look at, you know, Port Augustine and you know, and Uchenna, and they really look the part of a shutdown defense. And, you know, that will be the, I mean, to me, of all the things that are going to happen this year, if they get to that true shutdown defense, take other teams out of the game, that's the more than anything else will tell you how far this team can go. If that becomes this team, if they can go up and line up with Stanford and just say, we're not going to let you in the game. We're just taking the game away from you. Sorry, you don't get to play here. The way Pete Carroll's team did, or you force teams like Stanford to take chances and do things they don't want to do. And that was, you know, a big secret with Pete's team is his defenses took you out of your game and made you do, you know, do things you didn't want to do. And that's when they took the ball away from people. And we haven't had a chance to see that in a while. And I think that, you know, you hope that's kind of the change in the mindset with this team. And I get the sense from watching them in the summer how serious they are, how much coaching is going on between the older players and the younger ones. They're thinking the same thing.
We got a couple of quick ones. We'll let you go, Dan. Tark first. Do you see Jamel Cook as a legitimate option to start alongside Biggie Marshall at corner?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I know the danger with Jamel is if you got him thinking about three positions, the slot, you know, cover guy and the safety that he came in as and the corner, I'm not sure I want him spending time learning every one of those positions. I mean, my first take on him would be just let him go out there and be Jamel and play corner and take guys out of the game. And that would be the way I would look at it. So whether that happens or not, we're not sure what's going to, you know, be the situation with Jack Jones, but that might be where I'd go.
Do you have anything, Keelan? Okay. Oh, go ahead.
Dan got it.
Okay. David says, Ryan, last week you and Dan talked about changing next season's first game against UNLV to one of the glamour games against an opponent like Alabama, Ohio State, etc. My question is, why would you want to do something like that? We already play Notre Dame and Texas in non-conference. Isn't two such games enough? We clearly would make the playoff if we went undefeated with that schedule and perhaps even with one loss. Why add one more upper echelon Power 5 game to an already loaded schedule? From David.
Well, I think if Sam Darnold were coming back, then you might like that. And I don't know if we're talking so much next year. I just think the idea of with the new stadium that they're going to have in Las Vegas, and not to mention the new stadium in L.A., much like that they've done with the NFL stadiums, you know, in Dallas where USC played last year, and Atlanta, and Houston, all have those kind of, you know, intersectional matchups first weekend for TV. So I don't know that that's the worst thing in the world for USC, but they've got to pick their spots. I'm not sure you'd want to do it with a new young quarterback necessarily. But yeah, if you could get, you know, find, you know, say Florida State wanted to come out and play USC at a, you know, the LA kickoff bowl or something at the new Rams Stadium, where you could, you know, where a team might be willing to play you there, but not the Coliseum. That would, you know, or if you did it in Las Vegas at their new stadium, I think I'd be open to something like that. But you're right, USC, you know, kind of has a loaded schedule, you know, with Notre Dame in there. But I think if you get the program to where, and the goal has to be get back to where Pete was, and those games were good for USC. To be honest, those were good games. Those were good for the program. So I'm not totally against those at all.
All right, we got one last one. It's a voicemail question, and it kind of it cuts in and out. So I'll play the beginning for you, but you get the gist of it, and then we'll get your thoughts, Dan. Here you go.
Ryan, Chris from Delaware, your absolute biggest fan, calling for the Enigma, Dan Weber. He's one of my favorites, but he is a very not secret. We don't know too much about him. The only thing I've learned about him in my listening was last week that he likes wine and cheese. And I was kind of hoping that since we're in a down part of the season, you know, the camp hasn't started and there's no games or anything, that we could maybe get, you know, a little introspective about Dan Weber this week. So, Dan, my question is, what?
And it kind of cuts out there after that, but.
Can I just interject really quick?
Yeah.
I've been on the sidelines with Dan for like maybe 4 years now, and I barely know a lot about Dan. Like, I'll get little snippets here and there, but he is an enigma. He's a secretive person.
Oh.
Maybe I just don't ask.
Well, I had to look up the famous Churchill quote, which, where he, 1939 radio interview, they asked him about Russia, and he said, "Russia is a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma."
He always had some good quotes.
And Russia is at the top of everybody's, political thought pattern right now. I was interested, it's Chris from Delaware, right? I actually spent some time not that far from, used to drive through Delaware, lived in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, and I was a sports editor, Bucks County Courier-Times, and lived in Yardley, and lived in Westchester as well. So, actually, we were in Westchester, wasn't far at all from Delaware, so... So I know where of you speak. I actually interviewed for a job at the Wilmington paper. So I'm kind of familiar with your territory, but, to give you a real quick, history, was a high school coach, played high school football and baseball at St. X High in Cincinnati, which is, used to be the largest Jesuit high school in the country. Now I think, it passed Loyola of L.A. with 1,500 boys, but then I think Bellarmine, another Jesuit high school in San Jose, is now possibly number one. But we won the state championship in Ohio last year with a team that lost 35-6 in the opener to Bosco, which tells you how good high school football is in California. That's one of the big eye-openers, because we played in the Greater Cincinnati League, which was really and probably still is one of the great high school leagues in the country, the Catholic League in Cincinnati, where Mahler, Jerry Faust and Mahler and Cincinnati Elder, great programs. But when you see some of the programs out here, that's what the benefit of coming out here is, to see Bosco and Modern Day and Corona, you know, Centennial and Mission Viejo, and then obviously De La Salle in Northern California. I wasn't prepared. You know, I grew up kind of in between the Big Ten and the SEC country, right on the Ohio River. And so, you know, we went to games and, you know, we'd go down to Kentucky and watch LSU and Georgia, Auburn, there's Ole Miss. We'd go to Notre Dame and then watch Notre Dame games, go to Columbus, watch Ohio State. So we kind of felt like we were in the middle of the whole world of college football, which we were. But coming out here, it surprised me. USC always, I had run a trailing, and I'll throw all this stuff in, I ran a trailing college football Hall of Fame I put together for a year and a half, and did the Notre Dame-USC game in 1989 in South Bend, and got to meet the Pellerin brothers. We had a customized RV that was like a mini college football Hall of Fame, and people would come through, and you got to meet. And I ran into the Pellerin brothers, who had gone to like the one, Giles, I guess, had gone to 800 and some straight USC games home and away since the 1920s. And I had always had this picture of Southern California. It's like, you know, kind of way out there. And you ran into these guys, and they knew so much about college football and the history of college football. And then when I came out to Southern California, you realize, man, this place, these guys have been around for a long time. This is a program that was winning national championships back in the 1920s. So it kind of grounded me on what USC you know, what USC, you know, really was. But I was lucky. I was a high school football coach, and that has helped me, I think, immensely cover football. I mean, it just really, there are just things you can feel and the way you look at players and the way you look at how practice goes or the way you see games that I think it is a kind of a big advantage having been able to do that. I was also a sports information director at Xavier, which is my alma mater. We convinced them that if they gave big time basketball one more chance, as they had kind of faded and they were going in the wrong direction and hiring the wrong people, and convinced them that they had a chance. Xavier was one of the last four Catholic schools to have Division I football. Xavier, Dayton, Boston College, and Notre Dame. And when the Bengals came in, Xavier and Dayton just got killed. Their season ticket base really got hurt badly, and Xavier lost a lot of money playing football, trying to keep Division I football alive. And that was, it hurt the basketball program. And we tried to convince them, and they finally listened. They said, okay, we'll give them one more chance. And it's really paid off, and that's one of my real thrills, that it's able to convince Xavier that if you do basketball right, you could really have a good program. And I think the last Forbes magazine rates the value of college athletic programs, and Xavier was like the number 20 most valuable college basketball program. So was involved with doing that, and been a sports editor in the Chicago area and the Philadelphia, New Jersey area, and then California. So and came out. My wife got a job at the LA Times, which got me out here. And so I guess if you figure New York, Chicago, and LA, the top three markets in the country, which is kind of a places I would have never guessed, you know, I was going to end up. I mean, I was lucky. I got to cover the Yankees in Joe Torre's first World Series winning year when they beat the Braves. I just got to do a lot of, you know, pretty neat things. I got to cover the Bengals in the coldest game ever played in NFL football, 59 below wind chill factor, when they played the poor San Diego Chargers. They had to come from San Diego and play in 59 degree below zero wind chill.
Yikes.
Yeah, I mean, it just, you know, I got to cover a lot of Final Four. I got to cover Kentucky basketball. I think I was the only person, as a beat person, that covered both Kentucky basketball and UCLA basketball and compared the two kind of dynasties, you know, UCLA with, you know, John Wooden. And I started in Northern Kentucky, which is where I grew up, and that's where Coach Wooden started. He coached at a little high school right there on the Ohio River, Dayton High School, and could talk to him about, he still knew, he was 94, and he still knew all the names of the players he coached and where they lived, and all, you know, it was amazing. So some of that pretty neat. I think I'll throw this in. I got to, you know, talk to an awful lot of people. I covered the Bulls with Michael Jordan. But I think the most intimidating, most interesting person to cover, I got to do some Olympics and, you know, U.S. Opens and Wimbledon, and French Open, that kind of stuff. But talking to Bear Bryant, I think he was different. He was somebody, was hard to just be yourself when you talk to him. You knew you were talking to Bear Bryant. It was like probably nobody else that I can, you know, I can think of. He was one of a kind. But that was, I've just been very fortunate, gotten to do a lot of things and gotten to be in a lot of places. I was doing a story for a national physicians sports magazine, and the Lakers were playing in Madison Square Garden, and the theme of the story, we were about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar never got hurt. And he was a very difficult person to talk to. And everybody said, and he did this stretching. He believed in the stretching regimen that he did, that nobody else did. And he believed in it so strongly. And so, and most of the people in the Lakers locker room, I had never been out here, never knew anybody at the Lakers, but they said, oh gosh, you know, you want to talk to Kareem? I don't know. So I told him what I was doing. And it was like, like the light bulbs, he was so excited to talk about what he did and why he believed in it so strongly. I mean, he almost didn't go after the game because he was so excited, and nobody ever talked to him about it. So, you know, I got very lucky. And I go out to the court, and I had written a story about a guy in basketball who pretty much invented the jump shot, perfected the jump shot, and made it really important in the NBA. And he was from a couple of small towns that were underwater in Kentucky at the time. And he led the Philadelphia Warriors to the first NBA championship. And yet he died tragically, and he's considered one of the 50 greatest players, but nobody even knows who he is. His name is Joe, F-U-L-K-S, Joe Fulks, Jumpin' Joe. The only story I ever could find about him, I did a lot of research, only really good research, was by Dustin Hoffman's wife. If you remember, Dustin Hoffman and his wife were really big Knicks fans. So I'm standing there at courtside just watching him warm up. And I look and I realize I'm standing next to Dustin Hoffman, like elbow to elbow, like Keely and on the sideline. And I have to say, I kind of tell you, I did a lot of research. It was like she did like a 24-page paper on the jump shot and jumping Joe Fulks. I said, she did a great job. And I was, you know, it's really interesting, and I'm really appreciative. And he says, oh, yeah, I remember. That was really good stuff. And then he says, she's my ex-wife. Oh, okay. It's my ex-wife. It was, you know, just fun to be able to do lots of things in lots of places. And yet college football, by far, I think, is the best sport and the most fun. And there's just something about it. It's more a fabric of people's lives than almost any other sport. There's just kind of nothing like it.
Keely, did you learn a lot more about Dan there?
I did. That was like a oral history. It was great.
So, no more of an enigma.
So anyway,
Dan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Been there, done that. I've been to 49 of the 50 states. I still haven't been to North Dakota.
North Dakota? Wow. That's
Isn't that where
I'll get
the
there someday.
Mount Rushmore is? Or is that South Dakota?
South Dakota.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Never mind. Then why go
South Dakota is easy. North Dakota is a little hard. You got to really be going to North Dakota to end up in North Dakota.
Cool.
You walked it there accidentally.
Accidental.
I mean,
North
it's weird though. I mean, I helped actually start Northern Kentucky University's sports program. Started between classes that I was teaching at Covington Catholic High School, when their administrators all came up and said, "Yeah, we're thinking about starting." It was February, and we're thinking about starting basketball and other sports next year. And I said, "Wait, you don't have a coach. You don't have a schedule. You don't have a team. You don't." Well, so I had a friend who was really good high school basketball coach at Covington Catholic, and I ran out there and I grabbed him and I said, they're starting a program at Northern. Go tell them. You'll coach them. And he goes and tells them, and they hire him. So within a year or two, we end up in the NAIA World Series in Lewiston, Idaho, which is the airport where USC lands when they play Washington State. And I remember going out to Lewiston, Idaho, and thinking, I just went to the other side of the moon. You know, it's like, where in the world is this? And I had a few rain out days, so ended up in places like, I went over to Pullman, see Washington State, and I said, boy, I got to pay attention here. I'll never be back here. This is like so far from my, you know, my world that, you know, and I've been to Pullman, Washington now more than I've been to back home to Northern Kentucky in the last, 10 years probably. And it's just, you never thought you would end up in, in Pullman, Washington, as a sort of a regular basis. But, here we are.
All right. Dan Weber, Keely Yor, USCFootball.com reporter. We'll have to do a Keely's history probably won't be as long as Dan's, maybe, because
it's much shorter, for sure.
Was the abbreviated version by far.
Oh, okay. Yeah, there's a lot going on there, so that's cool. But yeah, thanks for all the questions and everything. And Keely, thanks for coming in.
Of course.
And Dan Weber, thanks for coming on.
Thank you. Very much fun.
Yeah, great stuff. Man, we went like an hour and 25 minutes on this podcast, so it's a little longer.
Wow. That's all Keely's fault.
I know. Keely's sorry. My bad.
Keely added all that. So, well, anyway, but I hope you guys enjoyed this edition of the Peristyle Podcast. We got probably no more podcasts this week. I had a couple of days of Pac-12 Media Day. Might do a Pac-12 podcast of champions from there. So we'll try to do something like that. But hope you guys enjoy this edition of the Peristyle Podcast, and we will talk to you next time.
You may have noticed that shopping at Trader Joe's is unlike shopping at other markets. People ask us all the time how we manage to have such unique, interesting, and delicious products at such great everyday prices. This is Dan Bain of Trader Joe's. The answer is simple. It's all in the way we do business. We buy directly from the manufacturer whenever possible. This helps to keep our costs low, and we pass those savings on to you. No gimmicks, just great values at honest prices every day at Trader Joe's. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the Peristyle Podcast, presented by USCFootball.com. Be sure to tune in next week for the latest news on Trojan football and recruiting. Don't forget, you can automatically download the podcast directly to your smartphone or tablet for free. Just click the iTunes link on PeristylePodcast.com or search for Peristyle Podcast at the iTunes Music Store.